Well, new lending laws are being described as a nightmare, locking many people out of the housing market. The new Credit Contracts and Consumer Finance Act regulations came into force earlier this month with the intention of protecting borrowers. Lenders are now very closely scrutinising borrower affordability, and loan applicants have to provide much more background information. Also, as of last month, banks will only be lending 10% of new loans, markedly reduced from the previous 20%, to owner-occupiers who have deposits of less than 20%. To discuss the tightening restrictions, Chief Executive Officer of Financial Advice New Zealand, Katrina Shanks, who warns that lifestyle choices may result in loan refusal. Kia ora, Katrina.
Good morning. How are you, Catherine?
I'm good, thanks. John Bolton is with us from the mortgage broking company Squirrel. He believes many borrowers may turn to lenders of last resort and has started a petition to the Minister of Commerce and Commercial Affairs to get the new law reviewed. Kia ora, John.
Kia ora, Catherine.
First, Katrina, can you just remind us about your organisation, Financial Advice New Zealand? This is an umbrella professional body for financial advisors, the financial sector, yes?
That's correct. So we're the biggest financial advice body in New Zealand, and we represent about 1,600 advisors, many of those mortgage advisors.
Now, let's begin with this change, the new lending laws that came in at the beginning of the month. This isn't just about mortgage borrowing, it's about all forms of credit. And what does it do in a nutshell?
So we're actually in a perfect storm. So CCCFA is one of those elements which has changed, and basically it's tightened up affordability. So when a lender, a bank or a second tier lender, for example, or a non-bank lender looks at affordability, they have to look at it with a different lens now. They need to dive down into income and expenditure a lot more and drill down and see exactly what's going under the hood. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, but what we're trying to understand is that these changes around affordability have made it much harder, and there's a lot less discretionary expenditure that you're allowed going forward. So previously, for example, they'd go, okay, this is your food bill, and that's non-discretionary, and this is your additional food, which you use, which you decide whether you want or not. And now all food is kind of put in together as one. So that is all non-discretionary. So what would have been affordable, the way they looked at your income and expenditure previously, may not be affordable under the new regime.
So they used to say, this is clearly discretionary spending. You need to cut back on this. We can see there's room for you to do that. Now it's just seen as total spend, and it's presumed you won't be able to manage what you weren't previously been able to manage.
That's right. So before, if you had takeaways are now included non-discretionary. Whereas before you did takeaways because you had that little bit of extra money and that's how you chose to spend that extra money. Now that's been put aside and said that it's basically non-discretionary. So all food is non-discretionary because you need to eat. Whereas before people were making choices about how they would like to spend their money.
Discretionary, sure, cut the daily coffee, cut the restaurant visit every now and then or the brunch on Saturdays, same, right? But you can they not have that conversation now?
Well, there's a lot more behind that conversation now, and there's not the flexibility with the new lending requirements for the banks. So the banks have got all this criteria which they didn't have before. The question you've got to ask yourself, was there harm for responsible lenders before with affordability, or wasn't there harm? And so what we're seeing, and I know John's got some good stats around the harm that was happening before and the harm that's happening now where it sits.
You said it's a perfect storm. What else is part of that perfect storm?
So there's CCCFA, there's the changes in LVRs, there's the increase in interest rates, there's the debt-to-income restrictions, which are now being putting on mortgages by some banks, and of course there's a change in the removal of tax deductibility for those that have rental properties. So there are five different levers that have all happened at the same time, and it's those five levers which have really tightened the ability to get credit in New Zealand for many New Zealanders, especially the average New Zealander.
Well, some people say that's a good thing. The housing market's out of control, people are overexposed, and in rising interest rates there's the risk of people getting caught out. However, isn't that an analysis the banks are supposed to make? And is what you're saying that it's become too blunt an instrument, taking away too much discretion from banks and possibly from borrowers?
Absolutely right. So what you've done is, as you said, all these changes have created environment where it's very difficult to get credit. Even if it is affordable, it's still very difficult to get credit. And we don't want people being vulnerable and not being able to afford the repayments or be in so much debt. But all these levers at the same time have just made it really hard for people to obtain credit.
For which people? Because house prices, evidence they might be starting to cool living off, ironically, around about from early December, and that is anecdotal at this stage. But for whom has it become particularly difficult to borrow? And are there still some people who can borrow because they, say, have a lot of capital or a lot of equity and assets?
Perhaps
John,
that's a
come
good
in, John.
opportunity. Yeah, I was going to say, and perhaps I can jump in there as an actual mortgage advisor. Look, I think the challenge is that if we were to simply look at this and say, okay, house prices are high, first home buyers need to be able to afford what they're purchasing. I think that's completely valid, right? And I think you're right in the sense that banks were already doing that. So we were already testing affordability based on interest rates of around 6.5%. And principal and interest repayments. So there was a buffer there already. This is adding an additional buffer to it. Where I think the issue is, and it's much wider than first home buyers, is that we've essentially moved away from judgmental credit decisioning, which means that, in the old days, you used to have credit managers that would look at a situation and go, look, I understand what's going on here. And I'm prepared to make a decision on that sort of looks beyond the numbers. And that disappears with this. So the sort of issues that we're seeing, they're not necessarily first home buyers, albeit that's going to be an impact. We're seeing things like, couples divorcing, where perhaps the person with the lower income that's got to look after the kids can't afford to keep the house. And it might only be for 4 or 5 years, and then they could sell it. They could afford it on interest only. But the way that the law prescribes it now, it's very difficult for a credit manager to approve that. I had one yesterday as part of the petition. I've been getting lots of stories coming back from people that are running into problems. And this is a classic example. This was an existing homeowner that has 60% equity in their property in Auckland. They intend to sell the property, but they want to do it up before they sell it. And the bank declined to top up on their mortgage. And to me, now look, to be honest, even under the new triple CFA rules, that should still be allowable. So I think part of
On what
what's
basis
happening
did they
here is.
fail with that much equity in their property? Tell me the actual nuts and bolts. Was it looking at?
Affordability.
Okay, so just hang on a minute.
Affordability.
Just talk me through the process. They've got 60% equity in that property. So to be blunt, if they can't pay their mortgage, that property can be sold. And they've got good equity. 60% is seen as good
Yes.
equity. They wanted to borrow. Just give me a ballpark of what they wanted to borrow to do up the house.
70,000.
And on what basis was that declined? On the basis of not being able to afford the extra interest on the 70,000?
Yes, because now their mortgage will be tested on a 6.5% interest rate, P&I plus the repayments on the extra lending, and they couldn't afford
So
that.
the whole mortgage was re-evaluated.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Is there another situation happening actually with moving house that could be quite serious, which is the situation we know it happens. You want to buy a house, you want to sell your house, you don't want to sell your house and get caught in between with rising house prices. Is there a problem with trying to smooth buying the new place and selling the old place? And what is it?
Yeah, look, that's actually a really significant issue in New Zealand, and that's existed for a while, not just as part of these changes. So the issue there is that under triple CFA, lenders are only allowed to charge fees to recover the costs of the application. And so with a bridging loan, you could imagine a bridging loan might only be for a month. Could be 2 months, 3 months, 4 months. So for a lender, it's very difficult to provision for funding for a loan that they don't know whether or not it will be required, and it'll only be required for a short period of time, but
They
they're not
charge
allowed to charge
high
fees
interest
on
rates
the loan.
on them, don't they, John, on bridging loans?
Well, they do, Catherine, but what if the loan's not even required? What if, for example, you put funding in place and they manage to get their property sold in time? or what if it's for a period of 2 weeks, or what if it's for a year? You know, it's a classic example of a fairly unusual situation, but one that hasn't been thought through in terms of how this law is applied, right? And so what it fundamentally means is that there are very few bridging loan options available in this market outside of someone's main bank. So you can still do them, but it really relies on your main bank coming to the party.
But is your main bank factoring in the fact you're about to sell one property when it considers how much it can lend you to another?
They do. So sometimes.
So that can still function. Okay, that can still function.
It can do, but you know, like I had a situation last week with a bridging loan where their existing bank refused to allow them to buy before they could sell, and they wouldn't release even deposit funds. Now, this was a house, to give you a sense for this, this was a $1.8 million house with a $100,000 mortgage, and their bank refused to advance a deposit so that they could participate in an auction to purchase a new property because they hadn't sold their existing one. Now, that's one bank. A different bank would have approved that. So what I'm now having to do for that client is refinance into another bank. They'll have to wait 2 or 3 months, and then we should be able to get them to a position where they can buy a property. But that really didn't help them when they were wanting to go to auction for a specific property last week.
Can we come back, please, to the... Well, again, that might argue that that is actually helping take steam out of that buoyant auction market, but it depends which part of the system you're in as to how you feel about it. Can we come back to the earlier one where they wanted to borrow $70,000, which I'm just doing the maths on, what is that, about 12.5% of the value of their existing mortgage, and yet were turned down? I don't want to breach privacy, so let's talk about it theoretically. What sort of a household income was there on that, and why was the 6.5% test, the stress test, which I don't think is that high? Many banks typically stress test on, I think they've been testing on up to 7% anyway, especially on large lending. Why did they miss the mark? What was the sort of income they were on that was so questionable?
So, Catherine, bear in mind this one was a response to our petition, so I don't have their full details.
Okay.
So I don't have enough information to talk to that one, but we are seeing this a lot now. So the sort of situations that we're seeing, so you'd have a 6.5%, testing P&I on their mortgage. One could assume this property was in Comarama, so one would assume that it could have been as high as about $1.8 million. So they could have had a $500,000-$600,000 mortgage. So typically you could afford sort of about 5 times your income. So that would sort of suggest that they would need to have an income of over 100,000. Where we would probably see a big issue is childcare costs. So if one of them was working, and we see this quite often, particularly with borrowers under the age of 40, where one of them may be working part-time and they've got childcare costs, that will significantly eat into servicing. There could be things like student loans that are also eating into servicing. So it's not uncommon for us to see household incomes of 140 to 150,000, where, when we run that through the criteria these days, it would be very tight for servicing.
But again, whenever you've had a typical main bank lending form sent to you, it will ask you about childcare costs and all of these things previously.
Yeah.
So student loans, that, you know, get rid of any lending, get rid of Afterpay or any kind of, get rid of the $2,000 on your credit card. All of that will have an impact on what you can be lent, right? So again, what's changed? And is it purely the discretion? Is it purely the ability of the bank to look at your spending and say, that's discretionary, stop doing it? Now it's just, oh, this is what you're spending. You can't have this. Does that sum it up?
Yeah, but you basically, and also look, I think just a general conservatism when it applies to these things. So when you think about a bank, think about the layers that exist within a bank between, you know, the people around the boardroom and the person that's ultimately making the decision in the branch or in the back office somewhere. There's a lot of layers there. And so what happens is when you have very prescriptive regulations that are as prescriptive as what we've got now with CCCFA, how does that filter down through the organization to the person that's ultimately in front of the customer or the person that's making the credit decision? And fundamentally, we've got a very compliance orientated culture that exists within our banks now, off the back of things like the Royal Commission. And,
well, some would say that's a good thing, John. Tell me about your figures. Tell me about your figures on where there has been an issue with this kind of lending being irresponsible. We know about the payday lenders. We wouldn't want to talk about irresponsible, right? And this credit contracts law. I've heard some of your profession argue that's what this is about, and it's caught up mortgages. But tell me if we've got evidence of irresponsible lending or unmanageable lending by the banks so far or not.
Well, so this is the interesting thing, right? So I would argue that banks are very responsible lenders and that they were doing a good job. So if we look at arrears rates, for example, the arrears rates on ANZ's home loan book, which is publicly reported, is only 0.5%, which means that 1 in 200 homeowners has missed a loan payment. That's a very, very low number. You know, the banks do a good job. They are responsible lenders. And what we've seen is the flexibility taken out of this, you know, the flexibility to sort of say, let's lend this person some money because they intend to sell their house. This example I gave you earlier, they were intending to sell their house and downsize so that they could be mortgage free.
Okay, so that flexibility goes. I understand. Are we seeing two things? I know we're seeing much longer wait times, which can have their own implications, although, again, others would argue slowing down the pace of this property market might not be a bad thing. But are we seeing long wait times also to get mortgages processed? And are we seeing an increasing rejection rate on applications, John?
Oh, we've definitely seen a significant increase in declines and also a significant increase in declines where they've been previously approved. So I think things have definitely tightened up. My concern, I just keep coming back to my broader concern, is not just about first home buyers and affordability of getting into their first home. It's the removal of flexibility for small business owners. A lot of what we're seeing at the moment is small business owners who are, you know, wanting to access capital for various reasons, which could also include residential property, and are really struggling. We're seeing things like, in fact, I had this situation just a couple of days ago where someone's selling a property. Now this is something that people are unaware of. They're selling a property, and because it's cross-collateralized with other property, the bank has to go through a full credit assessment to establish how much money it wants repaid from the sales proceeds. Now, you know, you could argue, again, from a responsible lending perspective, maybe that's warranted. But the amount of paperwork and the entire process now involved in the sale of that property is quite significant. And if a solicitor's only passing that information back to the bank a week before settlement and the person's already unconditionally sold, that can create serious risk.
Okay, thank you, John. Back to you, Katrina. Can you just finish with some anecdotes of what you've seen already that really does appear to create a kind of a perverse situation for some people, or an unfair situation for some people, or just put them in an impossible situation? Have you had some examples?
Yeah, like John, we've gone out to our members and asked for a whole lot of examples of what they're seeing and what they're experiencing. One of them is someone asked for a $125,000 top-up. They had joint income of $420,000. They had assets of $2.3 million. They had a mortgage of $300,000. So, you know, it's pretty serviceable. You know, 12 days later, they're still waiting for the bank to finish processing it. That's 12 days to just get a top-up on a mortgage that's still not processed.
But that is that just reflective of the time they're under, because those home lending teams are warning of long delays on everything. They're warning of delays on things like extra payments on your principal, things where there's no question of it going through a credit check. So is that just evidence of how everything has been slowed down?
Not slowed down. Yes, it has been slowed down. But what they're doing is they're just being so much more thorough on the information to make those affordability decisions as what they were before. And I think, Catherine, if I can just pick up on something you said, you're talking about triple CFA, you know, taking the heat out of the market. Triple CFA wasn't designed for that. Triple CFA was designed for affordability for vulnerable consumers. So you shouldn't be using a policy like that to cool down your market.
I tell you what happens, if you were a finance minister who couldn't find anything else that worked, you wouldn't be sad about it.
Yeah, but it may take a bit of the heat out of the property market, but you're left with, you know, when there's no heat, then you're left in the same scenario because triple CFA still exists, right? I mean, the purpose of triple CFA was to protect vulnerable customers and doing it through the levers of affordability. And that's what we should be focusing on. Is that component of it working? Yes or no? Is it bought in? Because what's the evidence showing us that there was harm being done with affordability with responsible lenders? They're the key questions you should be looking at, really. And I can give you another example sitting in front of me. This one is clients with less than 20% deposit, young couple earning 69 and 52K with no debts. As deposit is less than 20%, they don't meet affordability, and then too much for first home scheme. So they need lending of $520,000, and it's unaffordable because of the additional criteria on lending above 80% LVR.
So that's on the first home buyer's scheme being impacted by.
So they're based in no man's land. They have too much money to get first home scheme, but not enough money to be able to borrow. So they're caught exactly in the middle. And do you want to hear? I've got another one. If you'd like to hear another one,
please.
Due to the speed break applied by RBNZ on banks for lending borrowers with 10% deposit, my clients with 10% deposit are unable to buy despite good income and saving habits on existing property. This has put pressure on them to look for new builds, which are quite a distance away from where they work and live, to live, adding to more time for travel and travel costs, hampering the quality of family life.
Okay, so what you're saying is this is leading to perverse outcomes, and including for the very group that everyone wants to see getting into houses, which is the first-time buyers. Okay.
That's exactly right.
So what happens with the petition, John, this time of year? Who are you chasing down?
Well, look, we've got 6,000 signatories already in the first week. And that's literally from just a few posts on social media. We've had 126,000 views and over 2,000 shares now. Look, I think it will continue to grow over the holiday period. One of the things that we're finding, and certainly getting lots of stories that are getting shared, is that, you know, access to credit is just so critical to all households, you know. And I think as people run into this, as they invariably are, the heat in this space is just going to get greater and greater. It's going to get louder and louder.
I want to hear from you again. I've got a wrap, but I want to hear from you again, particularly about the business lending, because that has already been an issue. The banks have already been criticised for going after easy money in the housing market rather than lending to business people. And if that's got even tougher, I want to come back and revisit that, OK? Thank you both.
Sure.
John Bolton and Katrina Shanks.